How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin? Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanises them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Jade, and this is Future Setting. So the glorious human that we have with us today lives like tomorrow matters very gently and quite quietly. You may not know her name, but for those of us who appreciate good art, you will most probably know her work. And indeed, if you have the Future Setting book, you will definitely know her distinctive style because it features throughout the entire book, including the front cover. And really, if I'm honest, it makes the whole book what it is, sitting alongside Karen Webb's imagery. Really, it's what brought it all to life. She uses bold colour and abstract shapes, lots of repeated pattern and shadows in her work, and it jumps off the wall and into your arms, and in my case, into my heart. Megan Grant is her name, and given her introverted nature, this conversation has taken some convincing. So I'm glad that I continued to persist, and I'm glad that you had a New Year's resolution to take opportunities as they presented themselves, because finally, she said yes, and I'm very tickled to be welcoming you into this room. Hello.
Hi, Jade. Thank you for having me. That was a lovely intro.
Thank you for finally saying yes. If I could cover all of my walls in your beautiful work, I would.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, maybe. We'll get a few more your way.
Yeah, we need to just before we hit record, we were talking about the fact that I've got a couple of the originals that have come from my book that I don't have her signature on. So I'm just about to post them back to Megan so that we can get her her autograph at the bottom of the artworks that she has created. Megan, can I start by asking whether or not you have always been creative? Is this a language that you know intuitively, or is it something that you've had to fight really courageously to make a big part of your life?
I would say both of those things, but it has been something that I've always done since my earliest memories. Is I've just compelled to make pictures of things. I think in pictures and I dream in pictures and I draw and scribble on everything all of the time. Yeah, it is a drive. Like it's never died down. So I've just always wanted to make pictures, whether it's drawing or painting or sticking things together or anything. Yeah. But it has been a bit of a fight to make a life out of it. Yeah.
Mm, yeah, of course. My dad's an artist, so I understand that only too well. You said you've always made pictures. Is that your primary medium?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I love to be creative and, you know, I think about writing and film and all of these ideas that I have in my head, but they never come to fruition and it's always a visual medium, painting and drawing and, yeah, image making primarily. Yeah. Mm.
And you tell stories. And do you feel like it's your language?
Yes, I do. I don't know if it's a language that other people, that connects to other people, but I feel like I have to express myself that way. Yeah, it's just a drive. Like I can't stop doing it and I don't think I ever will. So, and I have endless ideas that I don't think I'll ever get through even a small percentage of them in my lifetime. So, yeah, I love that it's a never-ending drive that I have to make images. Yep.
Mm. And I said in the intro that you have incredibly bold, somewhat abstract sort of patterned style. That's not overly childlike. It's got a real maturity to it. Did you have to fight for that, or did you sort of stumble upon that as your style, or have you nuanced and worked at creating that?
I think I have worked at it. Just it's a constant process of editing, I guess, making lots of work that I don't like, that doesn't make me happy, and then finding the one that I love, and then trying to do that again and again and again and again. And eventually, I guess, just a natural style, you hone in on it. I think that's what I've done. And I do love naive art and then naive sort of shape making in my work. I love children's drawings and children's art more than anything, and that is a bit of an inspiration, trying to sort of tap back into that innocence of that, because that's really hard to do as a grown-up.
Yeah, to get out of your adult head.
Yes, yeah. I think that's one of my main goals, actually, when I'm making art. Yeah.
Yeah, when we first started having conversations that we were recording for the pod, we would often ask people if they were head or heart humans. And as you were saying that, it just made me think to ask you, do you paint intellectually or do you paint absolutely from your heart?
Yeah, that's a tough question as well, because when I'm painting, I sort of feel like I have two brains that are in conflict with each other. And that's a big part of my process, is teaching myself which one to listen to. Because there is all that intellect. I find it quite intellectually hard work making art, because I'm thinking so hard, but I'm actually thinking so hard about trying to stop the intellectualizing. So yeah, it's very intuitive and it's meditative, and finding processes to allow me to sink into that intuitiveness is what I'm always trying to achieve. But no, I don't plan paintings. I don't think about what they're going to look like. I don't organize the process. It's very much about the medium and just letting accidents happen, and feeling my way through them. Yeah. But there's a lot of mantras that go on in my head. how to think. Yeah.
You said, I found on your Instagram page, for anyone who hasn't discovered her on Instagram, get there, you will drool. There's a post that says, certain that she'd made a good painting at last, she pedalled home from the studio in the moonlight, fervent and giddy with glee. She awoke the next morning and returned, only to discover in the new light of dawn that she had made something completely fucking stupid, a real piece of shit. And there's a whole lot of people that have commented on this. And, you know, clearly people who are in the art sphere and understand what that looks and feels like. And you said a second ago, you have to make a lot that you don't like before you really sort of find stuff that you do like. And it's a really good analogy for life, really. Everything doesn't have to be a success.
No, definitely not. And in art, I think just showing up and making terrible work over and over again, you have to do that. Because otherwise you'll never discover, well, I will never discover the good bits. I've made so many bad paintings. And I didn't write that little funny piece that you read out. I found that little gem somewhere and it was so relatable to me. Just
I think even those who aren't artists, it's probably relatable to all of us.
I think so. You know, yeah.
Whether it's your garden or cooking or preserving or the way you hold your conversations or, you know, submissions of, you know, written pieces, whatever it is, if you've got even a little bit of creativity in you and you try it, the chances are that you'll need to sleep on it and probably have a different perspective on it in the morning.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's just how it is with anything creative. And sometimes even things that you thought were magnificent, you'll look back in years from now and go, oh my God, that was really awful. But that means that you're progressing and getting somewhere and developing.
Mm-hmm. It was reflective of where you were at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And mm-hmm. I don't want to stay the same and make the same work all the time. I'm always mm-hmm. trying to, I want to change all the time.
Now, you have recently finished an exhibition, and I noticed that you often have exhibitions, and it seems that they're often always at Fenton and Fenton. So they yes. are your gallery. How magnificent.
Yes,
to have
they are. They, they're really great at, they represent me and sell my work, and they have such a big audience of all different types of people. And I think they're good at connecting to quite serious art buyers and also much younger people who are just getting into mm-hmm. collecting and being interested in art as well. So I like that about them. And yeah, that was a big amount of work to do, and I'm happily sort of stepping back from big exhibitions for a little while, I think, to make some more.
How do you go, for someone who's really introverted, how do you go standing up in front of your work, standing right next to it, owning it, holding a sense of sort of quiet pride in it, but really publicly?
I find it terrifying. I'm confident in my work and I'm happy for my work to represent me, but yeah, like you said, that's my language, and I find it a challenge to stand up there and talk about the work, or but I'll do it. I'll oblige. And it's hard for me. Yeah. I find it hard.
Yeah. And you painted my entire book. So yes. I would love to know how that process unfurled for you, because despite what it might look like to the outsider, I actually wrote the book in the hope of being really, really collaborative and creatively collaborative with others. But because I went through a really big publishing house, they were magnificent in every way, shape or form.
Yeah.
But they have a very structured process and yes. formula, and it didn't help that COVID was overlaid. Yep. Right over the top yep. of us. But I've never seen you in person. I've never
I
met
know.
You and we've never spoken.
We haven't met.
No, and I feel like, you know, where these pieces, there are three pieces of the puzzle, and one was the person that created the words, and one was the person that created the artwork, and one was the person that created the imagery. And then another group of people kind of brought all that to life and joined it together like a puzzle
yes.
and put it out into the world. But I feel a little bit excited that I have just met you in person, because
yeah.
you know, you're sort of, you're on my every wall, on my every shelf, you're in my everyday existence, because that book is so full of you, but I never met you.
I know, it's lovely to finally talk to you and see your face. But yeah, that process, I had no idea how that would pan out and how that would work when I was approached to do the book, and it was quite swift. The artwork, I think so, yeah. But possibly if COVID, if it was different times, we may have been able to meet and chat about it in person.
Yeah, because I didn't even write you the brief. The creative director wrote you the
yes.
brief. And
yeah.
so when it came back and they said, look, trust us with this artist, we think she has the perfect fit and she thinks, you know, she's aligned to it all, I said, oh, without doubt, she is everything Future Steading is. It's not neat and tidy. It's not formulaic. It's not one size fits all. There's lots of bold, splashing colour that goes in all directions.
Yeah.
They're really reflective of the seasons. But, you know, they could be interpreted in any way that individual
yeah.
wants to interpret it, and that is what Future Steading really is.
Yeah, well, when I was given the brief, I thought, oh, wow, this is like my dream job. Because they said you can be a bit abstract, you can be gestural, and it's also a lot about flora and fauna and plant life, and they're my favourite things to paint and draw.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought this is really great, and I loved doing it, yeah.
And then you also did, you know, we finally finished it off with a couple of little tiny bees and
yes,
you know, pieces
yeah.
of fruit, and
yeah.
so it was abstract throughout lots of it, and then you really honed in on some really actual things, which were just beautiful.
Yeah, the little bees are very cute on the cover. I like
they
that
are. They're little, yeah. And they're raised. They've got little, they're little embossed bees.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. That was very cute. Very that was tempted. The very last thing, I think.
It was. We'd signed off on everything and I said, it just needs an animal. Can you see whether or not we need to do a goat? And they said, we're not asking you to do a goat.
Oh,
I said, what about a chicken? And they said, no, not a chicken. And they came back and said, we've got you a bee. And I was like, oh, I think a bee is my totem animal. I really want to put a bee tattoo on me, but I'm not brave enough.
That's funny hearing it from the other side, hearing that he went back and forwards with a goat and a chicken and then a bee.
They knew best. They absolutely knew best. I was grappling because I love goats and I love chickens, but a bee was perfect.
Yeah. I love the cover. It came out really well and, I was stoked to be a part of it.
So that's not the only thing that you have collaborated on, though. Is it your only book?
I could say that, I have worked on covers, small illustrations, but more for sort of independent authors writing their first novel, and I've never worked through a big publisher before. Mm-hmm. So that process, and with so much imagery, that process was mm-hmm. completely new to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was a steep learning curve for both of us, but I'm pretty happy with the outcome. But another collaboration that you undertook with Gusto and did magnificently was the work that you did with Gorman, the clothing label. Was it incredible to see your work come to life as clothing?
It was amazing. It was such an exciting time. And sometimes I still see people out and about in their clothes and I still get a kick out of it. Yeah.
I bet you do. It would never ever get old.
No, it doesn't.
How did it come about?
I'd actually thought about, I'd love to do that. I'd love to collaborate with Gorman because I'd followed, so many of their collaborations in the years prior. And I thought maybe one day I'll approach them and ask them if they would have me. And I thought, not yet. I'm not really ready to do that. I want to produce a bit more work so I can impress them. And then I got an email out of the blue from Lisa Gorman just inviting me to collaborate.
Wow.
And I was so excited. And she just ran me through the process and it was really quick to get off the ground. It was great. I loved it.
You put it into the universe and it came to you.
It did. I actually had a plan. It was one of my goals or, aspirations that I thought I would love to do. And, Lisa just contacted me. So I think she is a big art follower and she does I think she follows quite a lot of, up-and-coming artists, not necessarily people with huge profiles, and she's got her eye on what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She spotted you.
Yeah, I was rapt. I was very honoured. And so
talk me through the process. So you created work on paper or work on canvas? Work
on board? So they were all paintings. Mm-hmm. They were all oil paintings back then. Some of them were already in existence. So I already had these paintings with no intention of producing fabrics or surface design with them. And I was a bit confused and I said, how does this work? How do you make a fabric out of this? And they said, no, we love to take the art of artists as it was intended to be, as they made it. And then we've got, super skilled designers who will reconfigure it into a pattern. So, they didn't want me to design
the clothing,
a pattern. They said, no, we want you to design a painting as you would hang it on a wall. And then that's where the energy comes from in your work. So we'll turn it into a pattern. And they did that really well. And that I think there was five or six paintings that they used. And that's how they do it.
So they then created all manner of items of clothing.
Yeah. So I think it was a winter collection, and it was all a surprise to me, like what sort of clothing they would create. They did come back to me and they showed me this is what we're thinking, and I loved it all. And they did some.
Do you have any of it?
I do. I have all of it.
And do you wear it, or does that feel a bit strange?
It does feel a bit strange. I've got I've given away a few pieces to friends, which was nice to be able to do that. And I have worn a few things, but Gorman is the type of clothing that people comment on, which is why people love it. And I've worn a few things and people have said, oh, I like your dress, and I don't want to say it.
Thanks, it's mine. I designed it.
I've got my painting all over my clothes and my house, and so I do have it. I've got some beautiful bedding as well, quilt covers. And
that
like
would be
that.
Magnificent.
Yeah, it's really nice. But the good thing about the clothes, not that I wear them often, is just in my day-to-day life, I am covered in paint all the time. I can't have nice things. I get paint on everything. And I did get some paint on the Gorman rain jacket that I was wearing, but you can't tell because it's all painterly anyway, so the extra paint.
Oh, so it's a dream come true. Dad's got this old high school science lab coat that he's had for 45 years, and it is so, so, so thick, especially at the very front, that it almost stands up on its own. So I can only imagine that it just is layer upon layer upon layer, with the very first layer being the Gorman fabric that has got your artwork on it. How amazing.
Yeah. So all of my jeans are everything I have is – I try to not get paint all over everything, but I'm not very successful.
You paint at scale too, don't you? So when you do that, are you painting from an easel or are you climbing up and down ladders? Because some of the works that you've created are huge.
Yeah, I never paint anything that I can't reach. So I've done some 2-meter tall paintings, but you know, I'm not that tall, but I can reach up that high, or maybe stand on a milk crate. But most of them are manageable size, and I don't have an easel. They're always sort of just leaning up on the ground or on milk crates or makeshift shelving that I sort of put together in the studio. Yeah.
So you paint from a studio at home?
Yes.
And you've got little tackers?
Well, they're not so little anymore. I have a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old. So
can I ask the question? It still mesmerizes me now to do it. When I was a kid, we weren't allowed to talk when Dad was painting, and we were allowed in the studio, but only if we sat very quietly in the big puffy velour couch at the back of the studio and sat silently. And so we learned from a really, really young age just to watch and just to observe and just watch it come to life. And he paints with both hands, and well, he doesn't at the moment because one hand's broken, but he paints with both hands. And so you would just watch as the sort of intellectual and creative torturous process sometimes, because it wasn't always uncomplicated and straightforward, but you would watch as it came out of his mind and through his hands and into his brushes and onto the canvas. And watching people create and draw, even if it's watching them put their makeup on, is still my single favorite thing to do on earth, because it just mesmerizes me.
Did you find it boring as a child, or you loved it? You loved
watching it? Oh, I loved it. I think it was because it was a real privilege to be in Dad's studio, because it's where he created everything that our life was about, and our whole life was sort of sacrificed around Dad's art career. And, you know, we honoured it, and we were in a little bit of awe of it, and we thought it was really special. So I wonder if your kids have got the same relationship with it.
Yeah, from someone who was whose parent did that, because I wonder, I'm not sure what my kids think. They seem to think it's quite boring. But I don't know what they'll say when they grow up. Like, Mum was just painting all the time. And
do they come to your exhibitions?
They do. They haven't been to all of them, but they've been to most. They do it under obligation, I think. I don't think they love it.
Is that because they're 15-year-olds?
I think so. I think they're just they're preoccupied with their friends and their lives, and that's the most important thing in the world, which is good. Which is
Are they creative?
My daughter is very creative. She's 14 and she's always been just a bit like I was, just making things out of cardboard boxes and drawing and painting, and she's always she draws on her walls in her room and does all sorts of things like that. And my son likes to think that he's not. So they're polar opposites, really. Yeah.
But I wonder where she'll head. I am always intrigued by kids of creative parents, because it means that your life wasn't cookie cutter in any way, shape or form. It didn't follow some linear path that sometimes your mates are following, or the families of your friends have, and the house is always a bit more chaotic and the smells in the house are always a bit more reflective of the things that you're creating at the time. And, you know, terps permeates through your walls, and your clothes, as you say, are never quite clean. And so I think you know, you can't escape that becoming part of your DNA of who you are. And even my childhood stories are all forged around the different series that my dad was creating at the time. He always put it on site. And so we would go with him, or we would be really aware as he brought the mixed media back to the studio to paint the oils of where he was at. And he had this endless sort of commentary of the series that was coming to life and where it was going to feature at which gallery and where the exhibition was going to be held. So you sort of end up having, I think at the time you think it's a bit weird. You just want to be like the rest of your friends.
But did he paint in their house, like in a part of the house? Was a studio?
No, he had an A-frame. He has an A-frame studio that he built himself out of milled cypress timbers on the property. And it was a three-story studio, and the bottom story had a sunken conversation pit, and one end was where he does his oils. And then on the next tier up was where he had a drawing, big drawing table, and it's where he did all his pencil work. And then the third story was where he had a seat and his library with all his art journals and art books. And so it was just this dream place, and it still really is, except that it's now so full. Yeah, well, it's so incredible. Full that you can barely get in it now. You can barely fit. But would you say you are a prolific artist? You paint a lot.
Yes, I think so. Like I said, I'm always driven to do it, and I'll always keep making more. But I don't get to paint as much as I would like to. You know, it's balancing the parenting and the painting. That's always, I think, all parents who are artists are probably all a little bit torn, because you're compelled.
If you could paint every day, would you?
Well, I do paint almost every day, but school holidays, because I'm a single parent, so school holidays, especially the summer holidays, seem to stretch out for a very long time. And my kids don't need supervision all day long. They're teenagers now, but I don't like to just lock myself away and work all day when they're home. I could, but it's finding that balance, I think, as a parent is always on my mind.
And you said earlier, you know, it was definitely a bit of a fight to make this happen, to push for this as my career. Do you have other work as well that supplements the income that you make from your art? Or are you,
So I just paint, and sometimes there's other, you know, there's other creative work like illustrating and a little bit of designing things for people, but it's mostly just painting. Yeah, and it has been hard to pay the bills sometimes, or quite often.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've managed, and I'm really glad that I've done it. And I think it was part by design and part by necessity, because as a mum, when my kids were much younger, as a single mum, I wanted to be with them, and mm-hmm. painting was sort of something that I could do and not, yeah, and have still be able compromise. To look after them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But it's really courageous because.
Thank you.
Well, it's a sacrifice. That's a lifelong sacrifice to decide that that's what your world will be in, because it's not always financially rewarding, and it does make it tough, and you sacrifice lots of things.
Yeah.
And it's sort of complicated because it never really leaves. You don't shut the computer and walk away. It never really leaves you. It's in it's in your veins.
Yeah. 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 I mean, there's so much freedom in it as a vocation, as a job. You know, I don't have to be 9 to 5 in the city commuting and all those sorts of things. And yeah, I don't take that for granted, that the freedom is great, but it's also a sort of, you never leave work mode, or I don't anyway, because I'm always thinking, and when there's creative blocks, I'm thinking, how do I get past this to pay the bills? So when the creativity is linked with your livelihood, I think it does, there's a certain stress in that, but there's the freedom as well. So
what about creative freedom? So my experience is that you know, you kind of know what the customer would like, but Dad would always say, I'm not being led by the customer, I'm being led by my creative need. And if the customer likes it, that's great. And if they don't, well, it matter for them. But, you know, when the bills need to be paid, there sort of needs to be a happy compromise in that. But do you feel like you're compromised?
Not too often, no. Occasionally I'm doing projects where I'm very excited about something else and I wish I could move on to the next thing. But all the work I do is still pretty it's still interesting to me and still invigorating to me, because even when I'm doing commissions, pieces for a client, they've come to me because they want the style that I already love. Mm. So I still get to stay in that. I still get to play around in that sort of space. So no, it's never really, I don't feel like I'm compromising.
Mm. Wow, that is so incredible. And at the, when you said it was tricky to begin with, what at that point was your idea of success? What would success have looked like as you embarked on this as a career?
Well, I'm not sure if I had a plan that, you know, I want to be an artist with this kind of studio practice and this kind of reputation or anything like that. I just thought, I hope someone would want to buy a painting and maybe I could sell paintings and survive off that money. And it took a little while to get to that point, but yeah, I'm not sure that I don't think I even now have an idea of what success would look like, because I still feel like I'm just getting started in a way, because there's so much that I want to do. I still feel like, I feel like I've just started, even though it's been quite a while.
And how long has it been?
About maybe 8 years painting for a living.
Okay.
But, I went to university and I did a fine arts degree there. So I studied arts at uni, and then, so it was always a vague sort of direction I wanted to go in, but I didn't know that you could paint for a living when I was young at uni, at university. I just thought, oh, that's impossible. Nobody does that. So I guess, this is success, being able to do this. Yeah.
I remember Brenna Quinlan saying she used to draw on anything and everything, a little bit like you, and she said something along the lines of, I remember someone saying one day you could be an artist for a living, and she said it changed her whole world. It made her – yeah, she did exactly what you just
did. That's what I –
That happened. I could do that.
Yeah, I actually – I do remember going to the interview for the fine arts degree that I did and bringing my portfolio of work, and they said, so where do you see yourself and what would you like to do? And I thought, oh, I have to say something clever, like, or maybe I could be an art curator or work in, you know, arts and cultural management, or I thought I had to come up with some sort of job.
Legitimate, that felt like it fitted the system.
And I remember all the interviewers looked at me and they said, you know, they said the same thing. They said, being an artist is a real job. Wow. And I felt like I was told off a little bit, but it was also a light bulb sort of moment then. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's quite incredible, isn't it, that we see it as a folly. When we interviewed Tyson Yunkaporta, who is an arts academic, he said the academia that sits around art really is an abstraction. Art should be something that every one of us has the capability to deliver through whatever medium makes sense to us, whether it's through song or dance or drawing or sculpture or, you know, performance or whatever it is. Every one of us should have the right to it whenever we want and need it, and it shouldn't only be acceptable or encouraged when it has a dollar value associated with it.
Absolutely.
And so he was really challenging, because I said, but it's really important that we support our artists, and he said, of course it is, but all that does is entrench us further in the abstraction of the academic art world that means you can only do art if you are good enough to be paid to do it. What about all those that just want to express themselves through some kind of artistic medium? You know, and it really set about a bit of a quandary in my brain, because I thought it's really important that our artists don't go hungry, and that's the world that we live in. But at what point do we encourage all of us to tap into art for art's sake?
Yeah, well, I think it's so important to, I guess not everybody wants to be making art, but I think a lot of people really are creative, and it's just, I think it's a pretty important part of being alive, expressing yourself in some way. You know, it could be anything really, making beautiful gardens or designing things or painting, drawing, writing. It's, I think it brings a lot of peace and purpose to people's lives. Yeah.
And interpretation. I feel like we need our art world to sometimes state the bleeding obvious, or to shine a light through a different lens on something that's important for us to learn or to understand, or you know, to gently be the provocateurs of our community that allow us to be challenged in our thinking and change our approach to things without having a stand-up argument over it, because it doesn't always need to result in that. But our artists, you know, carry those strong messages of change and of our need to, you know, work together. And hope, I would love to ask you what gives you hope.
Oh, hope. That's such a big question. I mean, in terms of making art, I've often thought about this, like, I feel really lucky to have that, because sometimes I think if every single thing went wrong in my life, you know, health, family, money, I'd still have this drive to get up and do this. And I think that's a really, I'm not sure what that means, but I feel really fortunate to have that, and I don't take that for granted, that it's just like this endless source of, it is a hope and optimism to me.
Mm.
Like it's a, and I think it's been a big part of just kind of a robust mental health, really, because that's what keeps me going through all kinds of change and adversity. There's always that. And it's a sort of self-sufficiency, I think.
Self-containment.
Yeah. That's how I feel about it.
Do you use your art to make statements? You said you use it as a language, but do you use it to, you know?
I'm not sure that I do. You know, so many artists talking about the change that they're wanting to make in the world, and I like to consume that kind of art and music, and the written word, but I don't think that my art is about that for me. It's really self-exploratory, and I love that people appreciate it and they find depth, and people find all sorts of things in it that I wasn't aware of. So that's really lovely. But no, I don't think I'm trying to make statements with my work.
Do you think you ever
will?
And
I've grappled with that as well. Like, am I supposed to be, am I supposed to be putting statements out there? But I don't think I am, to be honest.
Mm. Who said beauty is its own reason for being?
Well, I don't know, but I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think about that a lot, that sort of thing. And is this legitimate work because of that? And I think it is.
It has a place.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. It's culturally soothing.
I guess. And that has soothing, soothing is one thing that, and people have told me they find, you know, or this piece brings me joy or peace, or, and that's enough for me, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the joy and the peace that I get out of it.
So I'd love to know, lots of your work has, as you said earlier, botanical shapes and patterns and representations through it. In order to find the inspiration for that, are you immersing yourself in the natural world, or is it mostly in your mind?
I take inspiration from all around me, but quite often I just notice everything, and quite often it's like really inconspicuous little details, like the weeds growing out of the footpath at the petrol station. Just I notice where life is sort of, you know, forging on in the random sort of places. So even though I'd love to be out in the forest and the jungle every day, I think I'm take more inspiration from just little moments of suburbia, and I notice details like that, and I bring, and also my imagination, they come together, and
Yeah, it's having the aptitude or the desire to take a deep breath and just slow a little, so that you've got time and capacity and desire to really see all the little tiny things where life exists, and what the different colours are and how different tones interact with each other. And so few people do that. I would say that, you know, that's probably a foundation for what makes you so good at what you do, because so many of us are so caught in the humdrum and the buzz and the pace of our modern day lives that we don't ever stop and slow.
Yeah, possibly. I think sometimes I think I'm too far the other way. I get lost in observations, and kind of, yeah, I'm not so good at focusing on the humdrum of everyday life, because sometimes I'm just, preoccupied with colours, looking at the way the colours of things work. And everywhere I go, that's basically what I'm thinking about all the time. And sometimes I would like to escape from that, I think. But mm-hmm. it's just a part of the way my brain works.
Mm-hmm. So you don't find it soothing. You find it sometimes a bit noisy?
Possibly. Yeah, sometimes I think, oh, I wish I would just stop composing images in my head because it never really stops. It's always there. Even when I'm talking to people, sometimes I'm not really listening to what they're saying, I notice, and I'm just looking at like the color of their shirt against the backdrop of the wall they're standing in front of and imagining a painting. So yeah, it just gets distracting for me.
Yeah, it is permeating every part of your existence.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
To wrap up really quickly, I get the sense that you will paint until your last breath, or you will draw until your last breath. But maybe using your daughter as an example, if she came to you and said, I think I want to have a go at this art world because that's how I need to live in order to feel like I feel complete.
Yeah.
What would you say?
I'd say go for it, my love. But I've got so many thousands of bits of wisdom that I would love to impart on both of my kids, and I don't know if that will be successful or not. But, yeah, I'd say go for it. Make art work. Don't wait for the inspiration to come. You have to go and make the inspiration mm-hmm. by working.
Mm-hmm. By doing.
Work, yeah, just make and do. And eventually you'll find your thing and your style and your drive and direction. I think I remember someone saying to me, you know, you can't wait for the inspiration to come. And it's a bit of a cliche. It's said to death now, but it's true.
Yeah, it's a beautiful saying for us to finish on. Just start. Start today and just do it. And if it just goes pear-shaped, do it again and keep doing it again.
It's bad. Yeah, that's a part of it. Yeah.
And I think not only in the art world, but all of the way we live, we need to just put one foot in front of the other and start right now.
Yes, definitely. I'm trying to apply that advice to my whole life at the moment, so yeah, it's a good mantra. One foot in front of the other. Yep.
One foot forward. Well, thank you so much. That felt special to chat with the magnificent human who created such beautiful artworks. They really do leap off the wall, or in my case, off the page. So if you're a bit intrigued about the work that she does, go take a look at her Instagram page, Megan Grant Artist. Thank you, Megan. I don't know if you will have listened to that, because you threatened never to listen to it because the idea just terrified you. But hopefully that wasn't too painful. Certainly beautiful to have the conversation. And I'm sure everybody who heard it agrees that it was a beautiful sharing of who you are and how you do what you do. As always, thank you for popping us in your ears. I hope you're enjoying the weekly pods, having gone from fortnightly back to weekly as we churn through season 8. We've got some great conversations already in the bag recorded for you for the next couple of weeks. This will be a 12-week season. If you're enjoying what you're listening to, let us know by sending us an email or a message. If you'd like to throw a few coins our way, you can do it either through an ongoing subscription with Patreon. The link is in the bottom of the show notes. Or if you think just this particular episode tickled your fancy and you want to throw a few coins in our direction to say thanks, then you can jump on to Buy Me a Coffee, also in the show notes at the bottom. If you don't want to do any of that, but you're happy to subscribe to us, click the link in whatever platform it is that you listen to your pods. It makes a really huge difference because it increases the algorithms to our pod, which means more people discover us. Thank you again, as always, for listening, and we will see you next week. Go gently.